I would say that's probably the biggest part, is really diving into how the business operates to make sure we're building something that does it as well or better than they already do. So we're not creating a new process for the sake of creating a new process.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, Noah Burnson and Peter Compernoll join the show to talk about e-commerce shipping and fulfillment. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by FosterMade, a versatile web development agency specializing in custom application development, content management systems, and user experience design. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, FosterMade is committed to building better digital experiences. Visit fostermade.co to learn more.
We've talked a lot about e-commerce on this podcast, but mostly from an introductory perspective for different CMSs. Today, we're going to take a deeper dive into e-commerce, focusing on shipping and fulfillment. To guide us on this discussion are Noah Burnson and Peter Compernoll from One Design Company. Noah has spent the last 8 years building websites and applications for partners ranging from Fortune 20 companies to mom-and-pop toy stores. A self-taught web developer, he's helped build One Design into a well-respected, well-run company. Peter is a senior software engineer who builds mobile web applications for One Design Company. With a background in mathematics and computer science, he's drawn to solving complex problems using Ruby, PHP, and Swift. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself? Noah, let's start with you.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from the Chicago area. I grew up here. Been working on things on the web for, I guess, about 10 years now, I think you mentioned. But yeah, I sort of stumbled into this. I have a political science degree that I'm not quite putting to good use. But yeah, so I have sort of a background working in Ruby and some PHP and things like that, and also focus a lot on the operations at One Design right now.
Very cool. So how about you, Peter? I saw from your bio you shared with us that you're fluent in Mandarin?
Fluent is a subjective term, I suppose. But yeah, I've been able to speak Chinese for a couple of years. I lived there for about five.
Wow.
I'm going back there on Sunday, actually.
Oh, very cool.
Pleasure, business, family?
I'm going to pick up my mother-in-law and bring her back to the States for her first trip over here.
Oh, exciting. That's fun.
Yeah, it should be a good time. And I'll be there for a week. I get to eat lots of good food and good drink and then come back.
Yeah, Leia just came back from that part of the world.
Well, it's Japan, China.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind
compared
of
compared to the United States, it's that part of the world.
Yeah, my sister is, well, I wouldn't consider her fluent in Mandarin, but she lived in Beijing for a year, and she's conversational in Mandarin, too. So I often joke that she's my Chinese sister.
Cool.
It's a beautiful language. I love the way it sounds. All right, well, let's actually get to today's show. Before we get into the topic, though, let's first talk about the types of e-commerce projects you guys have worked on, the types of client needs you've solved, and also what types of content management systems you've worked with.
Yeah, for sure. So over the years, we've done a lot of different types of commerce. Some of it like Field Notes, which we launched this past year, sort of traditional where we're, you know, selling things online that are shipped. Some of it's a little bit less traditional. We built an app for a local restaurant group here where you can order things and you order on your phone, you walk into the store, and we use beacons to detect where you are and fire the order into the kitchen. So it's still technically e-commerce, but a really different application of it. So, you know, it's really interesting sorts of problems to solve for us. And we've used a lot of different types of frameworks to do that. You know, some things are really custom. The app for Eastman is, you know, a mobile app, so that's all native. And then on the web, it's Rails on the back end, so Ruby. And, yeah, there's a custom API there. While Field Notes is built on Kraft, which is a e-commerce platform that I know, or a CMS that I know you've talked about previously, and we work a lot with Kraft. So most of our content managed sites at this point, I would say for the past 3 years, that's been our CMS of choice. Of course, we've worked with you know, a pretty wide range of them in the past, done a lot of WordPress stuff, a lot of Expression Engine, the occasional custom CMS, which is, of course, the thing we always say we'll never do again. but we really like Craft. It's really nice, I would say, both from our perspective, from, you know, building, designing, whatever we want. And then our clients across the board love it. Just the ease of use is great. We can really build a powerful content management solution for their, you know, marketing or content teams. And they can just do stuff that other CMSs haven't enabled them to do. So that's been our choice. And we worked with their commerce package this year to build Field Notes, and that was great too. It was really a pretty solid solution that let us sort of build the things we wanted to build in a way we were familiar with from Craft. In terms of e-commerce framework specifically, we've worked with Shopify in the past, which is of course a hosted solution, but has some great things going for it, and Spree, which is a Rails-based e-commerce thing, which I think got taken over by the Bonobos team and some other folks. It seems to be going in a good direction. And then, yeah, custom stuff as well.
So with this wide array of frameworks and systems that you've worked with, how do you make the decision on what to build for a given client? You know, I heard you say you're doing a whole lot of Craft work right now. Do you go into every project kind of knowing Craft will be the underlying system?
Absolutely not. A big amount of time for all of our projects is invested in the beginning to try to figure out what the client needs specifically. So usually we spend about 2 full days with the client to try to understand what their needs are, what's special about their needs. So e-commerce in general is a pretty broad idea. You know, you sell something using the internet usually and then deliver it somehow. But the two examples Noah just mentioned are completely different. They right. still fit that paradigm, but one is using, you know, a mobile application where the real nugget of, you know, what makes it special is location awareness, whereas the Field Notes website, they're kind of special. A lot of the content on their website is talking about how people use their product rather than the product itself. Mm-hmm. So we opted for Craft for that because they manage all of this content themselves.
Right.
So we usually try to figure that out early on, but it's different for every project.
Yeah, I would say the other part of that is we do focus a lot, as Peter was saying, on that early discovery process, and then we try and figure out what we can build quickly to validate a given solution. So we sort of stack up what our assumptions are, what our major project risks are, and then the first phase of any given project is typically a sprint to sort of eliminate as many of those risks and validate a given solution as quickly as possible. So in a case like Eastman, we knew the risks were, how do we integrate with a point of sale solution in a restaurant? And would people actually use this thing? And, you know, would we be able to accurately identify when someone entered the region? And so we built a prototype, I think in a couple weeks, for a mobile app that yeah. allowed you to place a coffee order. And that's all you could do. You pressed a button and you got a coffee.
So for the first couple of weeks, we identified the easiest way to answer those questions was to ignore the fact that people can eventually customize their orders. A big technical risk was here in Chicago, in the Loop, there are lots of glass and steel buildings, which makes GPS less accurate. So we wanted to test that while also testing the ability to send orders to their point of sale. So we brute force created an order with nothing but one cup of coffee, you know, no modifications or anything, already paid for. And that way, when you entered this area, it would automatically just send that standard order. And, you know, slowly we add more features as we discover that this is the right choice and this is the right, you know, solution to the problem.
And if you guys had discovered that this wasn't the right solution? Like, it didn't address that core functionality you had questions about? Mm-hmm. Would you have just shifted immediately to another platform? And do you build that into your project budget?
Well, for this particular project, everything was custom. So we mostly just needed to know what's possible, what would degrade the user experience so much that we'd have to rethink things. And so the client we were working with was very understanding of how software evolves. And, you know, we gave them fair estimates to say we think this will take about a week or so, or, you know, whatever, to figure out how to do this. But if we found any problems, you know, we could pivot from that. And so it was very much a living product almost immediately.
Yeah, and it sounds like you got the buy-in from the client early on for that.
Absolutely, which was critical for that project.
So I'm curious a little bit about the buy-in and the sales process for something like this, since it's still kind of a lot of unknowns, a lot of risk. And how do you get this type of buy-in? Like, for example, you said, oh, so we sent them some estimates. So basically, did you just sell just discovery only before even saying, like, yes, we can do a full-blown e-commerce project? You were just like, we need a 1 week to do this one thing and we'll see if the rest is yes or no.
You know, it's sort of a mix where we'll look at the bigger picture and give them some sort of range. So we know, like, if we're in this range, this is going to work out. And, you know, it sort of depends on the client too, because, you know, one of the difficult things I think in this business is that if you come to us and you want to build an e-commerce website and you have, you know, a budget of 100K or 500K, you know, we can potentially build a solution for you. It's just really figuring out what's the right solution for your business and what's the right investment for you. So it's sort of tricky, but we do often start engagements with that discovery phase. And it's typically a 1 week or 2 week sort of sprints where we have a dedicated team on there working really closely with the client, sort of ideating and then trying to solve some of these problems. Then we look at, you know, what our original high level estimate was and try and narrow that down and make some hard decisions there with them about, like, what's a good, you know, first real release for this thing and what's a sort of next phase of work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other nice thing about this process, we think, is it gives everyone a chance to work together and sort of to start developing a relationship. Because I would say the biggest sort of difference between our projects that are, like, super, super successful and the ones that are just, you know, good projects is that relationship where we have a lot of trust between the teams and people can be really open and honest and have the conversations that you have to launch products like this. Because regardless of what you're doing, there's going to be trade-offs. And it'd be really tough if you can't have those conversations in a way where everyone feels like they're on the same team.
Yeah, I love how, I didn't really expect to talk about this, but I do love this part of our conversation because it's almost a beautiful summary of the past episodes we've had this summer. Because, you know, we had Mitchell Kimbrough from Soul Space on, and he talked about this idea that in his discovery process for, like, a third-party integration, he builds a CRUD script to essentially test and validate if the core functionality is possible. And so you're sort of saying the same thing. It's not a CRUD script that you would necessarily throw away or anything, but it does sort of validate. But also, you're testing to see if this functionality is possible. So you're, you know, moving forward with proven data, which is the episode we had, Leia, with Matthew on data-driven design. Mm-hmm. And then this discovery, this engagement thing, we talked with Jay Cornelius at Nine Labs about the importance of discovery only, and especially for this client relationship thing that you're talking about. And I think it's really nice to hear how people are approaching discovery because, you know, it can be assumed to be one thing, but it can really be, you know, more, you know, I feel like we have an assumption about discovery being like you're just gathering information. But, you know, between what Mitchell was telling us about APIs and what you're saying, you know, discovery could also involve, like, some prototyping, some development to actually, you know, validate your assumptions. And I really love that idea.
That's exactly right. So a big part of it, when I first came to ODC, I thought the inception was mostly, like you said, to gather information. But after lots of successful discovery phases of these projects, I discovered it was much more understanding process. And for example, the more we get to know a client, the more we can answer questions sort of in their place. So
yes.
If our time is finite, so if we only have a week to do either feature A or feature B, you know, that's pretty clear. We can ask the client which is more important to them. But building software is thousands of these small decisions. Mm-hmm. And so the better we can answer the question for them, you know, the better the product will be. And likewise, the client has an opportunity to see, oh, wow, there really are 1,000 decisions that you need to make. So what's mm-hmm. important for me to share about our priorities and what's important to us, you know?
Yeah, I would say that's really important to us. And it's, again, one of those factors in what a successful project looks like. It's having someone who wants a partner and wants yeah. to feel like they're enabling us to make decisions as if, you know, we're a member of their team. And the sort of outside order taking process is one that we haven't found to be as successful. So people who want to spend the time to, you know, understand what happens every day and what the, you know, sort of minutiae is to a degree are the types of people we really like to work with and mm-hmm. you know, have produced some cool stuff with.
Well, I love that little turn that this discussion has taken. Let's talk about the main topic for today, though. And I think it would be good to define what fulfillment and shipping is to start. And just a side note for our listeners, we will link to our e-commerce archive in the show notes. And so if you want to get a more intro level look at Craft or e-commerce with Expression Engine or Statamic, we've got episodes on all of that that we'll link to. But for now, let's go ahead and define these terms. What is fulfillment? What does that encompass?
Fulfillment can take lots of forms. Typically with e-commerce, you think of websites where you select products, you maybe customize them, you make a payment, and then fulfillment is the everything that happens after you push go. So the store is notified of what product you've purchased, you know, a shipping address, things like that. And then someone somewhere, whether it's in a warehouse or, you know, the back of an office, throws it into a box and then ships it. But as we mentioned earlier, e-commerce takes lots of forms. So fulfillment for the restaurant that we worked with was actually, you know, creating a sandwich, throwing it into a bag, and then putting it someplace for you to come pick up. So really, I like to think of fulfillment as everything that happens after the front-end e-commerce experience.
Okay, and then how about shipping? You know, it sounds simple. Most people know the definition of that word. I know from experience it's complex. Can you explain what shipping is at its most basic?
So shipping generally is the step after that. So, you know, if you think of the life cycle of purchasing something, you select it, you pay for it, the store is notified that you've made a purchase, the store prepares that for delivery, and then gives it to a company like UPS, USPS, FedEx, who delivers it to your door. Again, that changes based on the business model and the product, but really shipping is everything that happens after it leaves the store.
So let's talk about the nuances then. So that's the basic. What else can shipping encompass for something a little bit more complicated?
So a topic a lot of people talk about when they analyze markets is the last mile, this idea of the last mile. So lots of parts of the shipping process, going from a warehouse to your front door, lots of parts of that can be optimized heavily. UPS trucks are big, airplanes are even bigger, freight trains and so on. But that can only get to a distribution center somewhere. And the last mile is a problem that people haven't really been able to solve. The last mile is the proverbial last mile where it goes from a distribution center, whether it's an airport or a train station or big warehouse in the middle of the city, to your front door. Nobody really has been able to solve this problem of optimization, though people have tried. Peapod, the grocery delivery service, this is one of the things that they've gotten pretty good at. Amazon is talking about using drones. Who knows if that will ever happen? Uber is even using their existing system of cars driving all over the place in residential areas, typically, to throw something in the trunk and then deliver it while they're en route.
And that's actually the last one is one that we're working on now, utilizing Uber Rush for a local wine retailer so that people at BYOB restaurants can order wine and have it delivered directly to the restaurant that they're at.
which is awesome.
they need to make that for like home delivery.
Yeah. And it can go there too, but it's the idea being that, you know, shipping does take a lot of different forms. And it is one of those things also that gets complicated when you think about e-commerce because of the options available to someone. And there's a lot of factors at play once you start calculating something like, how much does this cost? You have to understand, you know, from the end user's perspective, what it's, or the business's perspective, what it's going to cost them, which can change radically.
And that's one thing that Amazon, I feel, almost has done a disservice for everybody else. Amazon with Prime has made it so inexpensive and so fast to deliver anything. My wife and I are expecting a baby soon, and we've spent gobs of money through Amazon, and it's still 2 days later, you know, buy a huge heavy crib, 2 days later it shows up on our doorstep. And I feel like for companies that don't have that size or aren't willing to sacrifice their profits for market, I almost feel like it's done a disservice. People don't understand the cost of delivery anymore.
Yeah, it's completely skewed consumers' expectations.
Absolutely. I mean, I have strong opinions about this, but I feel Uber has done that as well. You know, they take lots of funding, they subsidize the drivers, therefore your rides are much cheaper. So already we're kind of losing the sense of knowing what it costs to get from place to place. You know, in the case of Uber, it's a human sitting in the car. In the case of delivery through Amazon or something, it's a product, but same idea.
So do you have those types of conversations with your clients, with your e-commerce clients, when you start discussing the shipping options for their online store?
We sometimes do. Typically, the business that we're working with already has a lot of that figured out. So we work with them to figure out kind of the user experience, which options we emphasize. For example, Field Notes has quite a loyal following here in Chicago. So one of the options is to come pick it up in their office, which is, you know, fun. And so we need to understand that and kind of what it means to them.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the biggest part is really diving into how the business operates to make sure we're building something that does it as well or better than they already do. So we're not creating a new process for the sake of creating a new process. So with Field Notes, you know, we had to understand what all of the permutations were of shipping, where if you picked it up, that's one option. Obviously, that's it's free to come pick something up. If you order a certain amount, that's going to be free. If you want next day shipping, that's an option. They also have wholesale customers. So if you are a retailer, you can sign up for an account with them and you have to have tax ID and all sorts of fun stuff. But that changes the way that you ship also, because if you're, you know, shipping a pallet of books, you're not, you know, the same thing as a person getting 1 3-pack of notebooks. And so you need a different set of options, potentially a different payment method either, where you get invoiced or something like that.
So. Yeah. So for us, a lot of that is just understanding what situations that's appropriate. So one thing, when people come to us, they usually have these ideas, you know, if they take phone orders, they can very easily understand, oh, you fit this category, therefore these are the options most appropriate to you. And converting that to something a computer understands is, you know, can be challenging. So again, to use Field Notes as an example, there are a few dozen shipping options if you look at it at its deepest level, but we don't want to show all dozens
right.
of those options.
Right.
So we need to, you know, understand using this logic, you should see these 4 options or 5 or something like that.
So how do you get to that? So what are the questions or the exercises or the scenarios you go through with the client to understand not only what the various, you know, let's say 12 shipping options are, but who the users are that see the different scenarios? What does the process look like?
It usually comes out in testing or, you know, after having the site live for a little while, when people realize this one option we used to have is not available in the right way. It's very hard to identify because there's so much what I call tribal knowledge.
Right.
There's so much understanding that they have about their business that we don't even know what to ask about. So we can get the really obvious things out of the way, and then it's the little stuff later. For example, to make it an option for in-store pickup, do we want to only show that as available to people in Chicago so people in Los Angeles don't think, oh, I'm going to drive to the store? We don't want to bother them with that option. But if somebody's address is in Los Angeles and they happen to be somewhere in Cook County, maybe they do want to come by. So that's where it gets a little fuzzy, and we need to work with the client to understand.
The first step in that process is typically sort of we build user personas, which I think is a pretty common practice, but it helps us break down the different types of people that are coming to the site. So again, in the case of someone like Field Notes, we're typically talking about a retail customer or a normal consumer. And then sort of admin users, there's some other random sort of people. But that at least gives us sort of a baseline to start that conversation and begin to understand all the different things. But then, yeah, you do run into edge cases all the time. And again, I think it comes back to how you have those conversations with the client and what your process looks like, because we could start the process by spending a few weeks doing that discovery and building out like use cases. And
for Eastman, the restaurant application we talked about, that was even more critical. So a lot of our discovery was understanding different types of customers. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, you know, building a mobile application that interacts with a third-party point of sale is more work than customizing a CMS to work the way you need. So, you know, in terms of budget and time constraints, we had to sacrifice or prioritize lots of things. So the more we understood the customers we were targeting, the better. So if we had to say, you know, all of the customers that come to the restaurant need these 10 features, but we can't afford to build 10 features. So the customers we want to use the app the most are only going to need these three. So let's focus on these three, for example.
So if these kind of edge cases that reveal themselves through testing and stuff, and that's something that you just go into accepting and discovering, you're not going to get all of those little details. Is that something you're also building into your budget to allow for that sort of unexpected, oh, we didn't consider this scenario? Or would
absolutely
that be considered? Okay.
Absolutely. And part of that, it's not really like we pad the hours, say we think this will take 10 hours, but let's budget for 12. It's much more, you know, this ongoing process of this edge case came up and we didn't realize how important it is. Therefore, this other thing we kind of hoped would be there, we'll do that later and reevaluate. So a lot of our clients come back to us, you know, once or twice a year after we build the initial release. And in the time that we're not working with them, they can come up with a sort of wish list. And then when we work with them again, we can prioritize things like that. I remember one edge case we were very worried about for the restaurant app was people being in the same building, but on a different floor. We were concerned, you know, if we use GPS or geofencing or something that's generally two-dimensional, what happens if somebody's on the 15th floor above the restaurant when they place the order? And that we were really concerned with, and it turned out to be absolutely a non-issue. You know, and part of that was because we decided to use beacons, which are three-dimensional and broadcast sort of a big sphere around them. But another part of that is because most customers that are using this app are coming from the suburbs or from other parts of the city, not from upstairs.
So, you know, you mentioned, we've talked a little bit about how you're handling these edge cases and you sort of embrace that as part of the development testing process. But, you know, for our listeners who may be, you know, newer to e-commerce, what are those sort of obvious questions that you do want to ask the client in the beginning about shipping?
About shipping, I think the biggest thing is understanding what situations. For example, product sizes. We can greatly simplify what shipping looks like to the consumer by offering ground, express, next day, or something like that. But, you know, maybe a product that we're selling is too big for one of those options. So that's a big question we have to understand. These are the options available. Are they actually available for every single product? Mm-hmm. Or is this one obscure product something that you need to order or custom make and therefore it takes longer? Things like that. So like I kind of mentioned before, it's easy to think things are very consistent And, you know, there are only three shipping options or something. But then when you really get into the nitty gritty, oh, there are many more. We can't do next day air to some country because that's not available to us. So we need to find those exceptions as quickly as possible. And then from there, we can sort of architect and design how we determine which options are available.
Now, how about for fulfillment? What are the kind of questions you're asking during your discovery phase about that part of the purchase process?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the most valuable thing that we do here is we go and look at what they're doing in person. You know,
You actually go to their facility.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, conversations are great, but, you know, we go and we see how it's done. So, for example, for the restaurant, we went and stood in their kitchen and watched them make sandwiches and pour coffee and everything else, you know, saw how the expo works, saw how the KDSs work, all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, one of the big goals that we had in building that product was integrating directly into their operations. You know, a lot of services today, you know, if you use Grubhub or something like that, Caviar, whoever, they're going to these restaurants and giving them like a tablet or faxing them stuff.
I went to a restaurant the other day that had probably 8 tablets at the host stand with different services like Grubhub and Uber Eats. It was nuts.
Yeah. And so, you know, if this is a fast casual restaurant and there's people coming in all day in line, you couldn't have that experience with someone having to, like, you know, say, oh, hold on, I have to take an internet order. Not okay. And so what we did, you know, our solution is goes directly into the kitchen and for, you know, the person making the sandwich, it behaves exactly the same way, as anything else. And the person at the front desk doesn't even know that it's there, cause it's really not something that they have to worry about.
It was almost so seamless that we had to change the way that we were doing it a little bit because the kitchen didn't understand sometimes, you know, if there's nobody in the restaurant and they started getting orders, it was sort of a foreign idea for them. Now, of course, they're used to it, but we had to change the order person, the customer's name, to say the word app in front of it,
right?
Just because it was otherwise so seamless.
Yeah. And for field notes, you know, we would go and, you know, their office and their fulfillment area are tied together. They're actually opening a store in their office too, which would be really cool. So they'll be announcing that soon. People will be able to go in there. You can go in there now, but they'll do a bigger thing. But actually, you know, in the back, they have sort of a warehousey area and a bunch of fulfillment spots, seats, I guess. And so, yeah, seeing how that all worked really helped us figure out a good, you know, sort of solution there. And we did a prototype and test. And so for field notes, they've traditionally operated in a way that, you know, allowed them to get stuff done really well, but wasn't necessarily making use of the, you know, latest and greatest in technology. So they had sort of custom stuff that they had built years ago and hadn't really updated as they grew. So their order process was a little difficult, where they'd have a packing slip and a shipping thing and they were separate. And if you've worked in a sort of packing area like that, it's sort of a confusing process. You have to start keeping track of like 2 pieces of paper for every order that comes out that come from different places. And so it was just getting to the point where, you know, it couldn't scale super well and it made everything take longer than it needed to. So finding a great way to make this all happen at once was really important to them.
Plus, this is what computers are good for.
Yep.
You know,
right.
a lot of businesses start off mechanical turking, using the easiest way. Why do we need to over-engineer a solution to some small problem? And then over the years, it gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's easier to just add one more person to keep doing that same thing, when it's nice sometimes, I think, for us as outsiders to the business to come in and see, well, you know, now you have 4 people doing this. We can optimize it in such and such way. It's also very important, you know, clients will tell us, this is very important, we need to do this. And then when we actually see how terrible the alternative is, it goes a lot longer than just a stern statement.
So all of this, to me, this entire conversation tells me how complex shipping and fulfillment can be. So if we take this back into development, how often do you have to customize things versus, you know, rely on out-of-the-box features? Because we started off talking about, you know, something like Craft Commerce and Shopify, which are pre-built and they have their own options. But considering all this nuance, how can you just use out-of-the-box features?
Yeah, that's a good question. question, and it really sort of depends on the business and where they're at. Someone like Field Notes is at a scale where it is so important to customize how things work to their, you know, operations. But for a lot of people, I do think that a solution like Shopify or Craft Commerce can get them a lot of the way there. And then, you know, there's a lot of great services you can integrate with. So for Field Notes, what we ended up doing was integrating with a service called ShipStation, and that enabled us eventually to get the printing and packing, or labels and packing slips, printing together, paying for postage, all of this stuff. And what we were mostly building was the integration between Commerce and ShipStation, which we made a plugin for it if anyone wants to use it. It's open. But to do that well, we had to evaluate all the options. We built an early prototype to actually start using ShipStation well before the site launched. So we started using ShipStation probably 6 months before we launched the website. And that was part of the initial prototype. So we built the very first prototype, again, you know, 2 weeks to a month. And it included, you know, we looked at all the different solutions that help with fulfillment and shipping. And eventually, you know, we demoed a few of them with Field Notes. And ShipStation was the one that we were able to accomplish what we needed to accomplish with. And then it was, you know, just making sure it was really going to work. And to do that, we, you know, they started fulfilling orders using it. Not all of their orders, just their wholesale orders, which are, you know, a little bit less volume. But again, finding the quickest way to determine how you're going to do this well is sort of the important piece there.
I think regarding your question, how much can you get out of the box? How much customization is needed? I think that question really goes beyond shipping or development of an e-commerce solution. I think I used to run a very small company that sold notebooks, and we identified very early on that the complexity of having lots of inventory was something we weren't willing to undertake. So we simplified everything to the point where we only had, I think, 5 products. And I think that was partially a decision that we made because we didn't want to build a complicated website, but also right. because we didn't want the business to be complicated. And in that case, we were able to make that decision because, I don't know, our customers were okay with it. So as far as what needs to be custom and what can you get out of the box, I think so much of it depends on how you're operating your business. So as a software engineer, I need to make decisions like this all the time. This thing out of the box does 90% of what we need. Is it better for us to adjust to work with that 90%? Or should we invest time and money and, more importantly, I think complexity in bridging that 10% gap? And it's a very difficult thing to evaluate. Complexity is extremely expensive, especially as products change over time. So to answer your question a little more briefly, I think it's really a difficult business decision to make which you can get out of the box and which you should customize.
If we can take a step back to talk a little bit more about the plugin you built for ShipStation. So I'm just curious, whatever Craft was offering in terms of, you know, I guess inventory management or fulfillment wasn't enough. And so you've created this plugin for it, and does it for the client, the end user, it's just a single process for them, or is there extra steps that they have to adjust for, or is the integration just completely seamless?
The integration is pretty seamless. You have to enter some account information so Craft is able to talk to ShipStation. And then if you aren't comfortable with writing code, you just stop there. It works as is. We did add some other customization options because clients we've worked with have needed them. So ShipStation, for example, allows you to send some other fields, and ShipStation doesn't need to understand what those fields are. But maybe, for example, with Field Notes, they want to know in ShipStation, is this a wholesaler or not a wholesaler? So we're sending that information as a custom field. And then Craft itself, we use a lot because it's so configurable and customizable. And so our plugin tries to live by that spirit as well. So we tried to make it customizable, but not necessarily.
And did you need to do any sort of customization on the shipping end in terms of when the customer is adding things to their cart? Are you integrated with like dynamic pricing or anything like that? And was that anything that you had to do custom?
So Craft Commerce product does all of that for you. So the only time we talk to ShipStation is when an order is submitted and paid for and ready to go. And then ShipStation will contact us, us being Kraft, to say, hey, I've shipped this, here's the tracking number, this is the price of the shipment, and so on. And then we log that using stuff that Kraft already does. So all of the complicated commerce aspects of the process, you know, this product with this modification costs so much, that's all handled by commerce. And then we just notify ShipStation to say, hey, somebody ordered this thing with this customization, make sure he gets it.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of an interesting point, because commerce does handle it. We have to configure the rules and things like that. And so while it's not technically difficult in terms of like programming work, it's just complicated business rules that people have to talk out and configure and all that sort of stuff.
It's a lot of bridging that gap. I've now come back to three times where it's easy when you're in a business to understand what these rules are, but when you're translating it into something that a computer understands, it suddenly becomes very complicated, which products are available in which way. And, you know, for example, when I was selling these notebooks, you could choose which paper type you wanted. Do you want graph paper, ruled paper, plain, or whatever? And so we made it very simple. Oh, you pick a notebook and then you pick the paper type. And while we were going through testing, we noticed that some products don't have all of these paper types. And, you know, that's something that as someone running this business and using these notebooks for most of my life, I had completely taken for granted that is more complex than that.
I think that's actually a nice segue to a question we got from a listener, because I think it's essentially about understanding business rules and working with the client to make decisions about that. So listener Jonathan Melville asked, I have a client that has pre-negotiated rates with FedEx. What's the best way to go about calculating their shipping costs in the cart? FedEx's dimweight shipping cost formula seems to make this very hard. So let's say you had this scenario. How would you guys go about figuring this out in terms of implementation?
So this is actually something that we dealt with. Commerce right out of the box, if we're talking about that specifically, has lots of configurations. So you can say they have shipping methods, which would be at a high level, ground, express, or super express or something. And then within each of those methods, they have a set of things they call shipping rules. And a rule, you can define when it's applicable. You can define the priority, meaning apply this rule first and that rule second. And then you can also define the pricing. So if it's fixed pricing, you can do that. Or if it's a percent of the product, all of these different things. So it's extremely customizable. If you can write a little bit of code too, then you can do anything you want, because with commerce, if you don't fit into that paradigm of this price for this weight or this percent or something like that, you can write your own custom logic. So one thing we investigated and ultimately didn't need to do was writing a customized shipping rule that would connect to these shipping services using our actual account and say, hey, this is what we're trying to ship. How much will that cost? We ultimately didn't need to, because the rules that were built in were so flexible as they were. But that was something that we definitely looked into.
So it was one of your things that you validated early on to see if it even worked.
Exactly. Yeah. Cool. And then it did get complicated, because we started using commerce when it was a pretty young product. And this we knew going into it and evaluated the risk, and it provided so much that other platforms didn't that we were willing to jump in. You know, for example, you could apply a shipping rule by country. So you could say, if you're in the United States, this is the rule to use. But you couldn't say, do this for every country except for this country, which meant, you know, at the time, it's changed since then. But at the time, that meant we either enter 250 some records, or we write a custom one. So we wound up writing a custom one to say, I think for US, Mexico, Canada or something. Yeah, so that was something that we were glad to have figured out early on, because otherwise it would have been, I won't say deal breaker, but it would have made our lives much more difficult.
So this, I feel like, leads into one of the things that you mentioned when we first started speaking about you guys joining us on the show. You mentioned there's some finer details a lot of people may not realize with e-commerce in general. Can you tell us like what the top points people should always keep in mind with e-commerce?
I have a few. I Noah probably has some as well. The thing for me, at ODC, we really greatly value the user experience. And, you know, part of that is in our control when we build it for, when we build things like this for clients. Part of it is out of our control. If the product line is already very complicated, there might not be much we can do. But in general, e-commerce platforms right out of the box all provide the same sort of functionality. And everybody's product line is very different. So it's sort of strange that that's the way it works. And what I mean is, you know, they'll typically have categories. You can browse by categories. And that assumes right away each product category has an equal weight. What if 98% of our products are in one category and then 2% are in these other three categories? Why do I want to browse by category? That seems silly. Mm-hmm. You know, and so Field Notes, I think our designer named Colin, he's not here today, he did an excellent job at identifying the way people would most likely browse or search for products for Field Notes. And that was to put it on one page. So it's sort of, I'm reluctant to use the word revolutionary, but it's this totally different experience from other e-commerce platforms. You land on the homepage, which normally says, hey, welcome to our website, click here to do stuff. And instead, you scroll down and you see all these beautiful products right there. And then some insight that Field Notes was able to provide was a lot of people read their blog. They call it a dispatch. And the dispatches are generally how people in different walks of life use their products. So there was a great one a couple months ago I enjoyed about a pilot who takes Field Notes with him on every flight. And so people will go and read that just because they're interested in reading it. And then we need to make sure that people can buy that product as they're reading it easily. So an out-of-the-box solution, of course, you can sell these products and people understand how that works. You click a product and you click something to modify it or quantity or something like that. But to really make it unique, you have to understand what the product is and what kind of people are coming to check it out. I'm not sure if that answered your question at all, but I think that's a very important thing to think about with e-commerce. These paradigms have been established for a long time and they don't always fit.
I couldn't agree more. I built a store a couple years ago and tried to buck some of the conventions I had seen out there because they just, I didn't care for them as a consumer myself. And I think it's a good point that e-commerce isn't just a transaction. It is a user experience. And if you really embrace that and like you said, understand your clients, customers, or audience, you can really create an amazing experience.
I agree. The company I had started a few years ago that I briefly mentioned and is dead now, we really enjoyed the sort of the connection between the digital world and the analog one. So we were selling notebooks, which means right away people are using something physical that they can hold and they're writing notes with a pen rather than a keyboard. And so we wanted to make sure, you know, assuming our customers enjoyed that, we wanted to make sure that the experience on our website was as close to that as possible. So we made it so you could order more notebooks without ever opening up a web browser. With each notebook that we would send, we would include a postcard already stamped and addressed. And then they could drop it in the mail. And, you know, we already have your credit card number and everything. So if we get it, you know, we'd send an email to confirm. And there are some boundaries that you have to stay within. But I don't know. I think that one of the more enjoyable parts of my job and what we get to do is think about these sort of different approaches to a very common problem.
I absolutely love that, especially because I am kind of the target market. I bullet journal and I love lettering and all those kind of things. And I want an excuse to mail anything. So if the experience was basically like, you done with this notebook here, just send this postcard. It's like, oh, here's an excuse for me to write my address in a fancy cursive.
I completely agree.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, guys, do you have any final pieces of advice for anyone who's dealing with shipping, fulfillment, or even just e-commerce in general?
I suppose the only advice I would have is advice I give in lots of situations, and that's something we touched on earlier, I would say try to avoid complexity as much as possible, because something that works when you're testing, when it scales, can quickly become impossibly complicated. And that's something that's hard to communicate. Even the idea of something being complex is hard to identify, but there is great value using something like an e-commerce platform right out of the box. Maybe customize the experience, but the more plugins you need to use, the more you're straying from this out-of-the-box experience. So as that evolves with security patches or, you know, new features or something, you're responsible for adapting everything else you're using. I generally give this advice anytime I build any kind of software, so I feel like a broken record in a way, but I think that's important.
No, I agree. I do think that that idea of, like, we're building this custom to some degree for somebody, but oftentimes we get to places where it's like, we could build this thing that's going to magically solve your problem that you have today through software, but someone has to maintain this and someone has to make sure this is how you continue to do it in the future. So rather than building something complicated, why don't we build something simple and have a person do this until we decide it's a problem? And so that's something that I think we say time and again is, like, there's problems that we can solve with software and problems that, you know, should probably be solved by people until you can really, really know that this is your process for doing things all the time. And now we can offload that.
And for e-commerce in particular, I would also advise, make sure your client understands that this is a living thing. And even if it's completely functional and working perfectly on its delivery date, in a year, the whole world's going to be a little bit different. You know, software changes. So it's important to make sure that relationship stays good and things are maintained and not neglected.
Well, we've covered a lot of topics and items here, but before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you both a bit better. We'll ask you both the same question, but to have some organization, we're going to start with Noah.
Oh boy.
Are you ready?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. First question, morning person or night owl?
Night owl.
Peter?
Morning person, absolutely. early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy and wealthy and wise.
Noah, what's one of your guilty pleasures?
Oh, boy.
Rapid fire, man.
I don't know. I don't know. I read it a lot. That's not really a guilty pleasure. Wine? That's not. I don't know about that.
I know my answer.
Oh, man. I know Peter's is also. Peter's is going to be better than mine.
All right. What's yours, Peter?
I was going to say wine.
Okay. I thought you were going to go pizza, but that's all right.
I started a website recently professing my love for box wine. Box wine changed my life. In Chicago, lots of restaurants are BYOB too, and they don't specify what that second B is for. So I like to think of it as bring your own box.
Well, and it's so easily portable, and you're not going to break any glass.
Exactly. And you can have a few glasses, and it doesn't oxidize. It's wonderful.
Okay, next question. What software could you not live without, Noah?
What do I have here? I mean, honestly, most of my life is just lived in a web browser. So it's nothing complicated, but today, you know, as much as I like building custom stuff and building apps and things, a lot of what I do is just through the web, whether it's Google Docs or our time tracking or email, all the fun parts.
So, Peter, what about you?
I realized a few years ago that what I enjoy about building software is using Vim, the text editor. So I'm going to go with that.
I thought you might.
Noah, what profession other than your own would you like to try?
Cooking. I'm an avid home chef, and I don't know if I could really deal with the stress of the whole operation, but I like high stress environments at times, and I really love to cook.
How about you, Peter?
I would like to be a wood craftsman, make wood furniture and things like that. Like, I still think I'll do that one day.
Why like not? Ron Swanson?
Sure.
Okay, so what profession would you not like to try, Noah?
Oh boy, yeah,
so many.
There's so most, I would say. I think being a teacher seems like the most stressful thing I can possibly imagine. I have so much respect for all my friends who teach, and it's really, really important work. But it just being in school gives me anxiety, I think.
I always wanted to be a calculus teacher.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's not my dream job.
Different strokes, I guess. I have a list of thousands of professions I would not enjoy, I think. I can't
think. Name one.
One thing. I don't know. There are lots of people that I work with regularly who do things that I admire and need. And as I say this, Noah just motioned a steering wheel. I don't want to have to drive cars. So I'll say I don't want to be a professional truck driver or something like that.
Race car driver.
Race car driver too. Yeah, no thanks.
All right, Noah, if you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Ooh, I think there's a lot. This is a great food town, but I'll go with a standby and say a Vec, which is on Randolph and is a great little sort of tapas-y place with an awesome wine list and just the nicest people.
We were going to try to go there tomorrow, but they're booked.
Yeah. Busy.
I would say a restaurant called Diwali, which is BYOB, because that's the only place my wife and I go to. It's Mediterranean. It's, you know, reasonably cheap. You can always get a table, and the hummus is the best I think I've ever had. So Diwali. Don't tell too many people, though. That's half the fun.
So, Noah, if you could meet someone famous, living or dead, who would it be?
Oh, man. I think my answer changed on Wednesday, maybe. But I'll go famous person I'd like to meet.
On Wednesday, because of the Cubs?
Oh.
Exactly.
Peter's a huge sports fan. Oh, yeah, sorry. It's still rapid fire. Yeah, I think I would want to meet some of the Cubs. That'd be like a good... Yeah, I do. David Ross seems like a nice dude.
Mm-hmm. Have fun.
Peter?
I'm not totally sure, but I always, you know, in my head, imagine what happens if I met this person. Would I act like an idiot or not? And the only person I can think that I would act like an idiot because I'd be so excited is Neil Young. I really want to meet Neil Young.
Right. If you could have a superpower, Noah, what would it be?
Oh, man. I mean, I think I'd probably go flying. That seems like just
flying.
Super useful and fun.
Oh. And you, Peter?
I don't know. Man, I kind of wish I were better at rapid fire, I suppose. I don't know. Lately, I really value time, and I'm frustrated with there only being 24 hours. So I kind of want to say I wish I didn't need to sleep. Does that count?
Yeah.
So what's your favorite band or musician, Noah?
Oh, wow. I was not prepared for this one. Peter, you're going first here.
Right, band or musician, that's tough. Can I give a top five?
Sure.
All right, top five of all time would probably be unordered here, by the way. Beatles, Radiohead, Neil Young, David Bowie, Bob Dylan. Yeah,
nice.
Man,
great list.
That's a good list. That is a good list.
Yeah. You have a very solid answer for that, Alina.
He's thought about it. Yeah.
So my brother, my dad, and I, once a year, toward the end of the year, we have a conversation of our top five for right now or for the year or something. So this is something I think about a lot.
Yeah, I have a really hard time with this one. I tend to sort of constantly reevaluate what I'm listening to. What am I listening to right now?
What's the best right now?
I really like this Anderson .Paak album. I've did that a few times, so that's really good.
All right, well, last question. Noah, pancakes or waffles?
Oh, boy. Can I be really specific in this one?
Please.
The waffles at either Publican or at Winchester. Winchester does these like yeasty, risen waffles that you dip in your coffee, and it's unreal. It's like the best thing ever.
Yeah, I don't like waffles, and that sounded good.
Sounded like a donut waffle.
I have Belgian heritage, so I feel like I should say waffles, but I'm not really a breakfast food guy, so can I say like a sandwich
instead?
What
about your egg pancake?
Like a Monte Cristo or something.
Hold on, I have an answer here, and this is going to blow your minds. In China, they have these things called jidanbing, which are, they're like crepes sort of made from eggs with green onions, and then they put this crispy long thing that's like an unsweet churro and then wrap it up, and it's the most amazing food ever, and I'll be eating one on Monday.
Ooh, yay. Yum.
Yeah.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online, Noah?
Probably the best place, you can find me on Twitter. I'm Bernsno, BERNSNO, but One Design Company is our company. And that's probably the best place to get in touch.
Okay. And you, Peter?
If you're remarkably good at spelling, you can go to petercompernol.com or on Twitter, I'm the lowly peon.
Thanks again, guys. It was really great to have you on.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Fostermaid.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech and Devotee.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune into our next episode, which is our last of 2016 for our year in review.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.